members to the table. So I'm going to do that and expect that they get here as we call. This meeting to order. I hope they get here. They are in the hallway, some of them. Thank you, Senator Osmond, for being here on time. We totally appreciate it. We did send a message to the members that they really needed to be here on time because we need to leave the room. Members need to be in other committees, so we have a pretty busy day. Thank you, members.
Thank you, member.
I'm the only one here, so I'm very appreciative of your...
I was here last night till 9, so
I know.
I'm really happy to be back.
I know this has been
a pretty tough week
for so many of us.
Senator Scalzi had to sit in the energy and environment with me. So
with you? Yes.
We had a fun five-hour hearing last night.
I think that went for a lot of people. Okay, so I think we're having enough members. I will call a quorum when we get quorum. Senator Osmek, thank you for your patience. I know you have been working on this issue for quite some time. So we are happy to have you in the committee. You have Senate File 71. If you could please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to present Senate File 71, an act relating to the Metropolitan Council. Before I begin with my remarks, I would appreciate a author's amendment, the A1 amendment that is in your packets, be moved so that I can have the bill in the shape that I would like it in for presentation.
Thank you. Senator Anderson moves the A1 amendment on... Oh, I'm sorry. We don't have a quorum, so we will wait until we have a quorum, and then we will move it, Senator.
I'll move it when we have a quorum.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Appreciate about that nasty little problem.
Yes.
So,
Senator Osmond.
The Senate File number 71 is an effort to bring local units of government into the appointment process for the Metropolitan Council and its representatives. It provides an opportunity for city councils to review qualifications of Met Council appointees and voice their support or lack of support for the governor's choices. The appointment process is painfully simple, really. We are not changing anything that the governor of the state of Minnesota gets for appointments. We are not changing the Senate's confirmation responsibilities. What we are saying is that once the governor appoints, then it triggers open a 90-day window where the Metropolitan Council appointees will need to go to the representative cities in their districts that they're going to be representing at Met Council and get a resolution of support. If they obtain 50% of the cities by resolution that they would be supportive, then they move to the Senate confirmation process. It doesn't impact one bit what is going to happen to the governor's process nor to the Senate's process. Lines 2.1 through 2.26 are the sections that actually apply to this and would allow them to move forward in the process. Lines 3.1 through 3.15 provide statutory language for cities to remove a Metropolitan Council representative, and line 3.22 exempts the Met Council chair from appointment or the removal process. The removal process is very similar to what I've asked for in the appointment process. Let's say that you have a city council or a Metropolitan Council representative that is not serving their district well. If a city council determines by resolution that they want to remove that individual, that would trigger open another 90-day window where other city councils could chime in with their lack of support for that individual. If, just as in the appointment process, if the person receives 50% of resolutions of recall or resolutions of non-support, then that Met Council representative would be removed and the governor would go back to an appointment process. It allows those cities to have a voice in the process, whether it be through the appointment or by the removal process. Lines, let's see, lines 4.6 through 4.13 provides language to deal with appointments that have not been acted upon by the Senate and the application of the appointment process. That's one of the reasons I have been so adamant about trying to get this into law at this point in time, because we are currently dealing with Met Council appointees for the governor's new term. My preference is to get this in place so that the current reps do have to go through this procedure. Otherwise, we have to wait 4 years in order to use this in law. It provides, again, the reason for this is to provide that local control, a local voice in the process. Many people on my side of the political aisle are very concerned about the Metropolitan Council, that they are not accountable. They are accountable technically to one individual and one only. That is the governor of the state of Minnesota. This makes them be more active within their cities. It requires them to get the support of their cities and actually seek out support. And it also gives them an accountability process where if they are not serving their constituency well, that they can be removed. With that, I have one testifier. The other one is not in the room yet. Next to me is Mayor Mark Connes, former Mayor Mark Connes. He is from my city of Mound, and he would like to testify on behalf of this bill.
Mayor, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just a little bit about myself. I've been around the block a few times. I've served on several boards and commissions in my city. I spent 10 years on our city council, took a two-year hiatus, and then came back and served another 8 years as mayor. So I've dealt with a lot of different governmental agencies and have experienced a lot of different things from a lot of different angles. I'd like to offer two very, very quick little examples of experiences that we've had recently with our Met Council rep and go through those quickly. The first one happened in 2012. We had a small Walgreens in town, and we have been trying to rejuvenate our downtown for about 20 years now. It's a very slow and painful process. They wanted to expand, and we were very pleased with that. They needed to move to a new area, and that required them to take out three fairly dilapidated storefronts, but also required them to take out a small 15-unit apartment building. Rub number one with this is that the apartment building was not zoned business, so we had to go to the Met Council to get a very minor comp plan update or change amendment. And rub number two on that is that those apartments were considered to be affordable housing, and so that raised a flag as well. We worked with our Met Council rep for quite a while. We did get it in front of the Met Council. I should say also that we actually have an excess of affordable housing in our town, not as stated by the Met Council dictates, but rather by virtue of the fact that we have all kinds of vacancies in that category that we can't fill. This particular building was half full, and the sister unit next to it was also only half full. So the owner was very happy and pleased to sell. He was able to move everybody from the one building into the other and improve his vacancy rate. Our rep ended up voting against us. She, for some reason, either couldn't or wouldn't recognize the benefits, if you will, to our community as measured against the loss of a few vacant rental units. That was one of our recent experiences that we just didn't feel we were being represented. The next one has to do with last year, and I think some people are aware of the Mound sewer issues that we experienced last year with the high lake levels and the very high rain levels last year, and we had some serious sewer backups and issues. Our real problem was we could not pump the sewage into the Met Council trunk lines because they were already full. Now, we were partially responsible for that, and we recognize that. But they also had problems with their system, and that was my big problem, is that they refused. Our rep and the Met Council as a whole refused to accept that there was anything wrong with their system whatsoever, and we've got horror stories on that I won't go into. But the point is that they have several problems out there. Anyway, We needed to create a workshop with them to try and come up with some short-term and long-term plans as to how to alleviate this problem. And so one of the things I needed to do was to get them to admit that they had some issues. Otherwise, we can't collaboratively work together and try to come up with plans that complement each other. So we had our workshop. And again, to that point, I still couldn't get our Met Council rep to admit that there was anything that they could do, that it was all a city issue, which it was not. Anyway, by the end of the meeting, I was able to get their engineers to agree that there were things that they could do, and yes, we could come up with some collaborative plans to alleviate the problem. We have been working on that. They've been actually pretty good to work with. We've had quite a bit of luck with their staff. I've just run into a brick wall with our Met Council rep. In this case, like I said, our rep was really more of a roadblock to fixing or finding the solutions, even though their staff was not. So currently, these Met Council reps are imposed, of course, upon cities. We have to work with them. We don't have a choice. The services that they provide, we have no choice but to use those services. I think we all know that they're largely political appointments, and I don't know that they're always vetted as much as they should be. And I don't care who's in the governor's office. I don't think that they're vetted as well as they could be from a technical perspective. We can all agree, I think, that the Met Council has some PR problems. They have an image problem. I mean, they're ripped in the paper. They're ripped in the news. Certainly, there's a lot of cities that aren't crazy about them, but they have to work with them, and so that's another problem that should be addressed. The functions that they dictate to cities are critical to cities. These are such as sewer and transportation, city planning. I mean, they all the time veto cities' planning. That if it doesn't suit what they want, they send it back and say, tell the cities, hey, or you have to change it to something that suits us a little bit better. So now they're expanding their roles into water service and eventually want to take over all the water service as well. And like I said, we're having sewage problems yet, and we're a little concerned about going into water problems, but that's a whole nother issue. When you have a rep that's not fully engaged or not competent in the issues that they oversee, it makes it nearly impossible for cities to try and make a case to them. It makes it very, very difficult. And I believe the cities are better positioned to gauge if a candidate is capable or willing to work these issues for the cities than a lot of other people are. So kind of in closing, this bill, in my opinion, would benefit both the Met Council and the cities that they serve. This bill will strongly encourage face-to-face interaction. It'll reduce the friction between the bodies as familiarity grows between them. And letting cities have input like this will increase their confidence in the Met Council, and in time will view it from a less adversarial position. The bill will go a long way to ensure these political appointments will serve cities better by ensuring they have the understanding and willingness to serve the cities in their districts, and it will also help to ensure that the candidates will better represent their districts, as is currently required in current law on lines 2.27 and 2.28 of the bill that's in front of you. That's already in current law. This bill will have a stabilizing effect on the Met Council, because regardless of who sits in the governor's office, these appointments will need to suit, at least to some degree, the districts that they represent, or they won't get endorsed. The bill will cause some cities to talk to each other more and share experiences that they've had with the Met Council. It's one step in the direction of getting these problems fixed, and it will happen, hopefully, before these problems grow and fester, as I believe they have for several years. This bill will promote better rounded debates and deliberation at the Met Council if they're better represented by those particular districts. And it'll provide more information to the Senate to work with when it gets to the Senate confirmation process. And this is information that the Senate may not otherwise have. This is kind of a sad statement, but right now, to be perfectly honest, we believe that at this point, we feel we would be better off with no Met Council rep than what we currently have, because she's provided more roadblocks than she has helped. So that concludes what I had to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor. A couple of issues that I would like to make sure the audience know. The jurisdiction of this particular committee is only about the structure that is proposed by the author. I know that in so many instances, as you recall, I have a bill that changes the construction of, you know, significant council members, and people have very good, strong opinions as to how those individuals that have been appointed function or don't function. It's okay to have those opinions, but we are here to really provide the author with some feedback as to how this structure that he is proposing actually could work or not. So I want us to make sure that you focus on what Senator Osmek is proposing here, which is the structure of the council. He has a very clear proposal about the structure of the council, how some members represent these jurisdictions, and whether or not they are good or bad people or effective or ineffective is a challenge. It's a conversation that I don't think is appropriate for us. So if we could focus really the questions to the author and the testifiers themselves, I know people are unhappy with the representation, but that's not what we are talking about here. We're talking about the structure that it is being proposed. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, do we have a quorum?
We have a quorum, and we can move now your amendment.
Move A1.
So Senator Osmek has the A1 amendment, and Senator Anderson moves the A1 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Osmek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment struck language that was going to definitely be unconstitutional. We cannot, and there's case law that specifically indicates that we cannot enforce upon the governor of the state of Minnesota a ban or a list of candidates. That is his prerogative, and that was not something that I had intentionally put in. Sort of in closing comments before I start taking questions from the committee, you may ask, why cities? Well, why not counties? Why not townships? Well, really, the reason I'm going with cities is because cities know if their Met Council member is engaged. They know with planning cases, with comprehensive amendment changes, water, sewer, transportation, they're very familiar with their council rep. The average citizen, this really goes past them because they don't interact with the Met Council. It really is a city function that they work with their staff or the city councils to get their jobs done. Another point before I take questions is I included with you a small spreadsheet of the impact of my proposal. You'll see at the top for the members from St. Paul and Minneapolis, I did a little quick little comparison of the population that they have on that first gray bar on top. The Minneapolis has 14% of the seven county metro or the metropolitan council area population, and St. Paul has 10.3%. The MC influence is how much that they would have under my proposal as far as an influence on the Metropolitan Council. So you can see that actually Minneapolis and St. Paul under my proposal actually would have a bit higher than actual population percentage. You'll see in districts 6, 7, and 8, Minneapolis will have a say in who that Met Council representative is. And particularly in districts 7 and 8, it's a 50-50 because this district encompasses Robbinsdale and part of Minneapolis. I have actually seen some comments saying that why are we letting a city like St. Anthony have the same level of voting ability as the city of Minneapolis has for District 8. Well, that is a glass half empty argument because in reality, with the removal process, if St. Anthony is the only one that gives a resolution of support to that Met Council district member, city of Minneapolis can immediately come back and put down a resolution of recall and take them out. So I think that probably is not going to happen because I'm sure that the governor is going to be appointing council members that are well qualified. I really don't anticipate that the removal process will be engaged very often at all. There's members on the panel here on this committee today that were former city council members, and they know that city council members and mayors in different cities are very unique, and they have their own opinion on many, many different issues, whether it's local or whether it's regional. You'll also see in District 12 and 13, there's two cities in red, Newport and St. Paul Park. They will have the ability to influence two different district representatives. So with that, I would just emphasize again that this is very bipartisan in nature. Senator Rest jumped onto this after talking with her for 15 minutes. She understands the importance of it. Senator Dibble and Senator Claussen are also co-sponsors. It is very bipartisan in nature. And I have not been able to find a city council member or mayor that doesn't think that this isn't at least an approach that's worthy of discussion or even implementation, because it gives those locals an opportunity to vet those candidates and make sure that they are some people that have the qualifications and skills that will serve them and will answer to them through the entire 4 years of their term. So with that, I'm open to questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Osmek. I understand that there are some people in the audience who wish to testify. Are there anybody in the audience who wish to testify? Please proceed.
Sorry. My second testifier is here. Mayor Laufenberger of Chanhassen is here, and he'd like to say a few words regarding the bill itself.
Thank you. Mayor, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I collect myself just a moment here?
Absolutely.
Cheers.
Yeah, sorry. It's okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Denny Laufenberger, the mayor of Chanhassen, Minnesota, Carver County, part of Senate District 33, Senator Osmek's district, and also Senate District 47, part of Senator Ortman's district. Also, Chanhassen is part of Metropolitan Council District Number 3. This is a result of redistricting that took place following the census of 2010 and subsequent Senate redistricting. Today, we are represented by Council Member Jennifer Munt, previously Gary Van Isle of Chaska, and prior to that, Craig Peterson, former City Council Member of Chanhassen. Now, Chanhassen is a growing and thriving community of about 25,000 citizens, making us one of the two largest communities in Carver County, the other being Chaska. We are proud of our character, our quality of life in Chanhassen. Our community has been recognized over the last decade by many regional and national publications and organizations for our parks, recreation opportunities, our excellent education systems, high employment, quality and diversified housing stock, and we are home to the National Weather Service for the Upper Midwest, the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and the oldest and largest dinner theater of its kind in the United States, the Chanhassen Dinner Theater, currently showing Mary Poppins. You're all invited. I'm here to speak today on behalf and support of Senate File 71, which, if enacted, in my opinion, would create a foundation for a more cooperative and effective relationship between the Metropolitan Council and the local government organization, the cities, that the council members are appointed to represent. Under the current language of Section 473.123 of Minnesota Statutes 2014, the appointment of the council members has very little linkage to the local communities. Yes, you may suggest that it's in the best interests of the council members to connect with their local communities. However, as I have heard stated by previous representatives, I serve at the whim of the governor. What incentive is there for a local government entity like the City Council of Chanhassen to invest in a relationship that is the product of that sort of guidance? I'm not saying that the governor shouldn't have the appointment authority. I'm simply suggesting that without some sort of local input and review, the motivation to stay connected with the local communities is lacking. Under the language of Senate File 71, there would be clear understanding that council members, while appointed or selected by the governor, would also be accountable to the entities, the local communities, that they are appointed to represent. Another consequence of this legislation is that by the participation on the part of the local entities, we in Chanhassen, we would have an obligation and a responsibility to invest in the relationship as well. I believe we would take a more proactive approach to investing in the activities than the decisions of the Metropolitan Council. I also believe this new approach that Senator Osmick is authoring would help us overcome the feeling of separation from the council that includes the feeling of taxation without representation. Now, last night I was present at a presentation by the Chanhassen High School speech team. They called it Speaking Up a Storm. And one of the students had this to say about speeches or other examples of oratorial excellence. He contrasted those speeches to women's skirts, and he said, they should be long enough to cover the subject, but short enough to keep your interest. Thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf of Senate File 71.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Chair, sir, that was really inappropriate, yes. That last statement.
I was reflecting the comments of a very skilled and impressive young man who spoke at a speech declamation.
Thank you, Mayor.
Still no excuse.
Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify? Please approach the table.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
So I would hope, I've been patient with our testifiers, but I would hope that we would contain our comments to the bill, as you said, and that the what appears to be personal attacks and inappropriate comments from our testifiers, I hope we could refrain from that and really focus in on Senator Osmick's bill.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Please proceed to identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetton, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on Senate File 71, and I also appreciate the opportunity to speak to Senator Osmick about this. We've talked about council governance changes over the course of the last couple months, and I'll keep my comments short unless the committee would like to ask some questions, but I have spoken to the administration, and the governor is not interested in moving forward this bill because there is a concern that there is infringement upon his executive authority to appoint council members and to remove council members and have them serve coterminous with him. And I can speak to the bill more if you'd like, but in the interest of time, I can just say that the administration does not support this bill.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for the author or the testifiers? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I appreciate, Senator Osmick, your wishes to make the Met Council more accountable to, you know, the people they represent. I'm fortunate that a few of the mayors or former mayors here had had less than stellar interactions with their representative. I'm just not sure this is the right approach. I actually might be interested in an election or staggered terms or some of those things, making sure all the counties are represented. I do have some concerns about just because a city council didn't act, that's an automatic assumption, that's a no on their part. I actually am interested in Senator Dibble's bill, which actually would look at the big picture here. And I know there's been several bills that have been introduced that wants to allow more accountability to the Met Council. So I'll probably vote no, not because I don't share some of your concerns that you have in your communities, but I think maybe I'm not sure this is the right approach.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Osmick, I agree with you that the Metropolitan Council has some serious issues and it's broken and that we need to do something, but I am not convinced that this is the answer. And I, too, would support Senator Dibble's version. And let's look at it from all angles, get the governor on board, and find a plan that all of us can handle.
Madam Chair.
Senator Osmick.
In response to Senator Dibble, I appreciate your comments. I do have a bill in for staggered terms. I think it has a lot of merit. Unfortunately, governors have said yes and said no multiple times to that particular, and that's why that is not in this bill. I'm trying to keep a clean bill, and that's what I'm asking for on the House side, too, is that we have an option that has not been, muddied up with a lot of different additional options. Elections are, I thought about that, and I know that there's many organizations that think that they should be directly elected. The problem is that the Met Council representatives really don't interact necessarily with individuals at an individual level, like a city councilman does or a mayor does, the interaction that Met Council reps really have are with their city councils. That's why putting it in a position of the city councils makes more sense, because they really know what's going on, whether the rep is helping them or impeding them as far as their success as a city. I appreciate Senator Eaton's comments. I actually would be very happy to serve on that particular board, because there's many different options. But I propose this because it is, I think, probably the best solution. It does not impinge upon the governor in any way, shape, or form, but it does put in that local ability to have some type of influence in it. It doesn't change his appointment. Some people will say will want to strip the governor of the appointment process, and I highly doubt the governor of any time at any time in the future will allow his authority to be stripped from himself or from future governors. So this is probably the most benign way to go at some level of local control. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Osmek. Any other questions for the author? Any other questions for the testifiers? If not, I need somebody to move a motion.
Madam Chair, so move.
Thank you, sir.
As amended.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'd request a roll call, please.
Senator Thompson has requested a roll call, and a roll call will be taken.
Torres Ray?
No.
Eaton?
No.
Hall?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Dahl?
No.
Hayden?
No.
Housley?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Pappas?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Scalzi?
No.
Wicklund?
No.
Oops. Thompson?
Yes.
Yeses and 8 noes. The motion is not adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You, Senator Osmek.
And I'm sorry in regards to comments that have been made regarding the testifiers. I think we were trying to give you some case information as far as why cities are having the troubles that they are having. And those types of actual, real, on-the-ground examples are ones that I think the committee and us as legislators need to be aware of. That being said, I appreciate your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Senator Osmek. Senator Dibble, you have Senate File 1560. Welcome to our committee, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Co-author on that bill, I should be upset. Mm-hmm. Didn't pass. Actually, Madam Chair, members, one of the bills I introduced doubled down on Senator Osmek's idea, so. The governor would like it even less if it if it got through. So, Madam Chair, members, I have Senate File 1560, and there is an A1 amendment, which just buttons it up a little bit and brings it into conformance with some of the standards for establishing advisory groups, councils, task forces, et cetera.
Thank you for doing that, Senator, because we really need to have that.
Thank you to staff who looked it over and came back for me.
Thank you, Ms. James. So on the A1 amendment, Senator Eaton moves the A1 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Dibble.
So very quickly, Madam Chair and members, I would just second the number of comments and observations that have been made already by Senator Osmek, as well as members of both parties at the table, about the need to have the Metropolitan Council function in a somewhat different manner. I think I will say, however, that I'm a strong supporter of there being a highly functioning and effective regional governance structure. I think metropolitan areas that have good and sound regional governance perform better across a whole host of measures. But they function the best in those areas where there is a lot of collaboration, a lot of advice, consultation, transparency, so that the other units of government come together around ideas and initiatives, services, allocation of resources that are larger than just themselves. And that happens here in the Twin Cities in large measure, and we have a lot to point to and a lot of success to be proud of. But we've noticed, as everyone has observed in the last few years, some tension, friction, unhappiness, communities feeling not fully participatory, not fully engaged. I can say from my own experience as a leader, as the elected representative of 80-plus thousand constituents, that in years past I've felt much, much more connected, much more communicative, much more collaborative with the leadership at the Metropolitan Council than I felt recently. I think everything I've articulated could be remedied by processes, procedures, protocols, expectations, leadership at the Metropolitan Council coming out of the executive branch, and I hope that occurs. But some of it could perhaps be baked in as a function of how the Met Council is authorized, what their responsibilities, what their duties are, and how they're constituted. I've thrown in a couple of bills trying to further that discussion. One of them is a variation on Senator Osmick's bill. Another one is elected Met Council. It's clear, though, that when you start off with all of the optimism and hope of a new legislative session, you're going to have all this time to have all this conversation, and we're going to work it through and work it out, and time gets really short. And clearly we don't have the time to work through what is a significant and difficult problem. And the other practical matter to consider is that the governor needs to agree with whatever idea this is, and the region needs to agree. A federal law tells us that any kinds of changes we make that are in this order of magnitude need the consent of the municipalities that represent 75% of the population, as well as the largest municipality. And I already know that at least some of my ideas are not supported in part or in whole by the League of Minnesota Cities Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. And so we need a process by which we really come to consensus around what would work best for our region, just to improve upon something that's already pretty good but maybe not working as well as we had hoped. And so I would propose this task force on metropolitan governance that names a variety of members and stakeholders. Their duty is outlined on line 2.10 to study and evaluate models, et cetera, and then to make a report and a recommendation to the legislature. Legislators would serve on this, so I think that causes us to travel, make a trip through rules. See how they feel about it. They usually hate putting legislators on these things, but I think it's a good thing to have legislative representation, unless you disagree. I'm not super invested in the composition. I just think there needs to be a broad representation of folks who know something about these issues and can have this conversation and make these recommendations and create a larger regional buy-in to whatever concept is developed.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. And I, as a chair of this committee, I totally appreciate what you've done. As you know, we had about six bills on this issue. I think three of them were yours. And I know that you've been working with a tremendous amount of people, and I couldn't possibly have a hearing for all of them because we have not brought consensus on the issue. It seems that a lot of people really want to have a say from their own communities, and we need to have a hearing that really brings all of those perspectives from the local communities. Unfortunately, people wanted to talk about things that were not related to the actual composition of the council and how it could be restructured, as you previously saw. So this will require a tremendous amount of time. I think we have to listen. Obviously, the structure is being proposed to change some of those dynamics that are happening at the local level. So it's a process that needs to happen. Perhaps this task force can really take a number of hours and all the time that is necessary to really bring those local perspectives to the table so that we listen to what is happening and what they propose as a solution to have strong representation and voice from the local community. So thank you, Senator, for bringing that. Senator Peterson, Senator Anderson have a question. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it our intention to move this bill and refer to another committee, removing this through the process? I didn't know if it's an informational hearing or what.
No, this is a hearing of the bill.
So I would hope, because I've served on a number of task forces myself, and the reports that come out of them at times don't go anywhere and oftentimes sit on the table. There's no action. I would ask the chair, we see the report is due on February 1st, 2016, that we commit to having a hearing sometime shortly after that date. You can have a task force, you can have hundreds of task forces, and oftentimes, like I said, nothing happens. And I understand circumstances can change, but for what it's worth, I'd like us to commit to doing that, and you as chairman to hearing it out. I think also it's worth pointing out, Senator Osmek and Senator Dibble have done a lot of work in this area, and I respect that in a bipartisan way. But one thing that's important for the legislature to recognize up front is, while it's important to take the input of the administration and work with the governor to the extent possible in good faith, both Governor Pawlenty and Governor Dayton have, you know, been not very willing to see changes. Governor Pawlenty explicitly rejected a reform proposal, and I think we may at some point have to assert our own authority as a legislature and make a suggestion that may not have 100% agreement with the administration. I don't personally expect a day, Republican or Democrat, Governor, to come out in support of a proposal that limits their authority in any way. So anyways, I would ask for that commitment from you, Madam Chair, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Absolutely, Senator Peterson. I commit to do that. I think that, some of these bills, Senator Osmek really worked hard to bring his proposal early to us. And I have said to him, absolutely, he'll get a hearing. Then other proposals started coming in, the staggered terms and all of these things that were not part of his bill. He said, well, I don't want to compromise my bill because I want, as he stated in committee, I want this to be clean, a clean proposal. So we were, all of these members were coming to say, but it's incomplete. So it's too complicated to have that conversation, just in a couple of hours here. So my hope is that they do this, and definitely we will bring that at the very beginning of session so that you will have ample time to have this discussion and weigh in, because this is ultimately going to be our decision. It will not be the decision of the task force. The task force will only submit a recommendation that ultimately we have to review and figure out if we want to adopt. Senator Anderson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm kind of piggybacking on what Senator Peterson is mentioning and saying. I'm just asking a question, Senator Dibble. I think we've had task force before studying this thing, and it's like been studied to death in years gone by. And I'm just, if you could give us some kind of an idea of what the results were from some of the former studies or some of the former task force on this, and like Senator Peterson already said, Governor Pawlenty didn't go along with this here, and so I'm just wondering, from your gleaning back or looking back at some of the results of those task force, what do you see as something that different could come out of this task force next February?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson. What I should put in here is this time with feeling into the bill. I would expect that that this task force will take a look at a lot of the work and a lot of the conversations that have occurred prior. There have been, I think, two or three, maybe four different task forces kind of outside of legislative authorization to do this sort of work, other than the work of the legislative auditor that took a look at metropolitan governance with respect to the provision of transportation and transit services, allocation of resources, that sort of thing. And there were some soft touches on some suggestions on some of those governance issues. So we'll take a look at the legislative auditor's report. I don't remember specifically what those things said, but there are some suggestions there. There was a regional discussion at the municipal level, and some discussions came out of that. I think, if I might be making this up, but I seem to recall some suggestions around staggering terms, doing some blended version of what's called the Council of Governments, so that elected officials could serve on the Met Council. Right now, there's a prohibition in our state law for elected officials to serve in that dual capacity. In other regions, these regional governments are entirely comprised of something akin to a joint powers, where there are elected officials. So the recommendation that had come from that particular report was some blend of that. It's one of the ideas I was trying to get to with one of the bills I proposed, and variations like that. So a lot of good work and a lot of good discussion has been done. I think sometimes it's just good to take a fresh sheet of paper, take a look anew, take advantage of that work. This is specifically directed by the legislature. That would be qualitatively different.
Senator Johnson, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble or anyone else who might be ready to answer. Since we're looking at the structure of the task force, what is the difference in the structure of the task force that was set up whenever the last study was? Then my second question is, certainly I hope you're going to have former Representative Myron Orfield on this task force.
Careful.
Because he has been an advocate for a change in the Metro Council for a long, long time.
Senator,
but my question seriously is about the makeup of the structures.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that Senator Orfield will come and testify strongly before the task force. But Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson. I don't remember specifically. Some of the task forces were self-initiated and took place outside of the purview of the legislature. And they pulled a number of folks, very similar to this, to the table, but mostly a lot of city officials. In one instance that I recall, I believe there was some variant on Citizens League taking a look at these. So these are kind of self-initiated conversations and ideas that were brought forward. similar but not identical. And in response to your question about Senator Orfield, he literally wrote the book twice on this subject. So if he's not on the task force, we certainly would call him forward to share his research. The statement that I made about well-functioning regional governments performing well in a lot of measures comes out of an extensive body of research that he's done.
Absolutely. Senator Dahl, Senator Anderson, and Senator Skalski.
Madam Chair, I was just going to move the bill as amended, but if you have more comments, feel free.
It seems like we have Senator Anderson, Senator Skalski, and Senator Hall. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, has the governor weighed in on your bill, as what happened in the last bill? Any comments from that?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Shetnan said that the governor is comfortable with this analysis, that going forward with this task force.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess as soon as you put something on paper, we understand how political metropolitan government can be. And thank you for doing what you're doing. I've been a part of efforts in the past with you and Representative Hornstein related to reforming the Metropolitan Council. So I agree with where you're headed. But now I'm coming to why do we have – so maybe you can explain to us why you would have on line 1.17 – that one of the two county commissioners has to be from Scott or Carver.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, I will confess that this bill was actually written by my counterpart in the other body, and he came up with that idea. So I can't speak specifically, and I didn't ask him about that, I'm guessing it's because Scott and Carver, or one of the five collar counties that aren't a part of the county's transit improvement board, they are ex officio. They have a seat at the table. They just don't have a vote because they didn't enact the quarter cent sales tax in their boundaries, and they seem to always carry a unique perspective from a kind of a minority perspective, and we wanted to be sure that that their views were represented.
Seems like Senator Dahl has a comment about that, Senator Scalzi. Senator Dahl?
Well, Madam Chair, and representing part of Scott County, I just think that I don't know if they've ever had anyone on Met Council from Scott County. It could be. But I know they feel that they have really been left out of the process. So that may be part of the feeling behind that.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi, follow up?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. But I would feel more comfortable with this, and maybe people are trying to get away from the two largest counties having too much representation if it were Ramsey and Hennepin. But I can see where that's a little troubling to me in the East Metro, that they would have a place at the table. So if that's the interest, maybe to have two of those members be not of the major counties, I don't know. But this is troubling to me, and I would not like to have that in there. And the other thing that is troubling to me as well is, so we've got one person appointed by the mayor of Minneapolis and one person appointed by the mayor of St. Paul. So we admit that there's 2.8 million people in the metro area. Minneapolis and St. Paul only comprise 700,000 of those people, which is a fourth. So we're sort of leaving out all of the suburban areas as a stated representation, and the suburban areas are the largest population areas in the seven county metro. So if we're going to have one person appointed by the mayor of Minneapolis and one by St. Paul, we need more than the two people on line 1.13 representing the entire suburban area. It's way out of whack.
Line 8.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble.
I'm open to any changes that the committee would like to make to the composition. Like I said, I'm not super invested in the composition. A suggestion I would make is that we could, on to the earlier issue on the CTIB appointments of commissioners, we could move that up to three county commissioners, maybe make sure that there's some language that the East and the West Metro are represented. I think Scott and Carver aren't considered East or West Metro necessarily. They're considered small, the smaller, the least populated counties. And then if we'd like to, move up the number of folks who are representing cities appointed by the metro cities, we can move up that number certainly and make sure there's regional balance, East and West, North and South. I don't know.
Senator Scalzi.
Yes, I would appreciate if you could work on that. I see that you do have two persons representing suburban mayors, but still it's not in an equitable fashion of representation between suburban and metro and inner city St. Paul and Minneapolis in my mind. So I would appreciate you working on that and looking at a little bit more equity east to west and suburban to inner city. And I don't know just what that would be at this point, but maybe you can give us some assurances that before this comes to the floor that you would represent the areas more equitably.
Yes. So Madam Chair?
Yes.
So I do have to stop off in rules, and Senator Scalzi, maybe you and I could work on some of those details and come up with a mutually agreeable proposal.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Sorry, members. I'm just consulting with our counsel because we have full jurisdiction over this, and so what we have to make sure is that the changes express the will of this group, of this committee. Number one, and number two, that the changes cannot be so significant that it has to come back here. You cannot just reconstitute this whole thing because this is what is being approved here. So they will have to be, Senator Scalzi, they will have to be very minor changes that are explicitly incorporating the will of this committee. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I agree with that. And I think that Senator Dibble and I could go out in the hall and figure this out in 10 minutes so we could bring it back. Would that be okay with the rest of the body?
If members are in agreement with that, I think that will be appropriate, that we can table and come back. I think, Senator, you have to go, though, right?
No, Madam Chair, my committee has commenced.
Okay. Yes, Senator Dibble has to go chair his committee. So, Senator Peterson, do you have a suggestion
Madam
for this?
Madam Chair, just speaking as a longtime advocate for Minneapolis or St. Paul, not that I have anything against them. As a suburban member, I actually don't have a problem with the structure that you have outlined here. I think there's a lot of opportunities for folks outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul that are proportionate to the population makeup within the Twin Cities. So I would support the language, I guess, as it is. You know, you see the two persons representing cities in the metropolitan area. There's no that doesn't necessarily mean they have to be from Minneapolis and St. Paul. Two county commissioners certainly aren't represent Scott or Carver County aren't going to be from Minneapolis and St. Paul. The one person representing a township isn't going to be from Minneapolis and St. Paul. The person representing a bargaining unit, that's going to be more their allegiance anyways. It's not going to have anything to do with the city. Same with the chamber. And then two persons representing suburban mayors. I actually think it's pretty well balanced. That's my take, Madam Chair.
Members, so we have to kind of move. He has to go chair his committee. Senator Dahl.
I'd like to move the bill as amended.
Madam Chair.
Senator Halts, my apologies. Yes, you had asked for.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Senator. Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, I just want to state that I appreciate what you're doing here with the task force. I think most of us have seen that the Met Council has gotten out of hand and overreaching. And at least my communities have been pretty much up in arms about it. I think that we missed a real opportunity to at least start with a big beginning with the OSMIC bill. I don't know if we'll get another chance at something like that or not, but that bill for me was a vote against our communities and for the governor. So this task force, I'm going to vote against it, but it's not because I don't appreciate it. It's more because I feel really bad that we missed a good opportunity to begin to change something that's really out of hand. And so I just want to state that so you know.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hall, I fully respect your position.
Thank you. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I would propose an amendment on line 2.3 rather than, and I respect Senator Peterson's thought that there could be more suburban mayors on there or suburban representation. I would propose that we strike the word 2 and insert the word 4, which would be somewhat more indicative of the population disposition in the metro area.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be comfortable with that. We'd also then need to increase the number on line 1.8 to 19.
And I would include that as part of the motion.
Okay. Members, any questions on that motion? If not, Senator Scalzi moves that oral amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. On Senate File 1560.
As amended.
As amended, Senator Eaton moves Senate File 1560 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to rules. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
The bill is passed. Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Tomassoni, we have Senate File 656. Welcome to our committee.
Are you going to stay?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator, if you could go ahead and start presenting your bill and bring your testifiers.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, now that you're done with the metropolitan problems, we're going to go up to the range. And
there's no problem.
Senate File 656 is an interesting bill because of what it's trying to accomplish. And the purpose of the legislation is to correct the mistake which occurred decades ago by the county regarding at least 29 parcels of land on the Iron Range, and it's specifically in a little location called Sparta, and it's outside of Gilbert. And the mistake that's creating significant problems with the county property tax record system, and if it isn't corrected, it could cost the county taxpayers over $1 million to remedy. So there's 29 parcels, and a situation exists where the underlying landowner, who is various mining companies, is a different owner than the owner of the structures, and that's basically the mineral rights of what's underneath the property. So only the underlying land has a legal description assigned, which triggers the assignment of a formal parcel identification number to it. So over time, the county began allowing people to homestead their structures by assigning them a site number, but not assigning them a legal PIN number. So approximately 10 years ago, some of the mining companies informed the surface owners that they must begin vacating their homes, and consequently, many of the surface structures have begun to go tax forfeit. So this legislation will allow the county auditor to reverse the forfeiture on the homes, combine the building parcel with the underlying parcel number, and finally make these properties a whole parcel with one unified parcel identification number. And finally, this legislation will also remove any unwarranted financial liability the county could have for removing homes and buildings off of the private property. With me is John Angaro from St. Louis County, and I don't know if you want to add anything or not.
Please identify yourself for the record.
John Angaro, Government and Relations Director for St. Louis County. I believe Senator Tomasoni gave a very thorough summary of what this legislation will do. It is a problem that the county is very concerned about because it is really a totally unique problem that we have never run across before, and I doubt any other counties have either. And so this legislation will help remedy the situation. And as far as the underlying landowners, they do not have to worry about any of the back taxes that were owed by the surface buildings. This legislation will eliminate those back taxes, basically do a reset, so the underlying landowner will not have any tax liability because of what happened with the other parties, the owners of the buildings on top of their land. So we think it's kind of a win-win situation, and would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, is a Peter Coyle going to talk? There he is. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle with Larkin Hoffman. I represent a group called Winona Properties. We're one of the landowners that would be affected negatively by the proposed bill that's being offered this morning, and we would be affected in this way. And I acknowledge the issue that Senator Tomasoni is trying to address on behalf of his constituent, which is essentially the county. It's not unusual for counties to assign a tax ID to a separate structure that is being leased independent of the land. But I understand the desire to unring that bell, if you will. The burden for the landowner, my client in this instance, is, and the county's honest about this, and I credit them for that, there's a cost associated with these abandoned structures now that the county would rather not bear. And so the proposal that's before you, apart from reattaching the property ID information that they're seeking to address, would also shift this cost back to my client, one of the landowners, and the county has identified that that's approximately a $25,000 per structure cost associated with that. So I just have to note that concern that that's a cost that we didn't anticipate would be our responsibility based on the forfeiture action, and we just want to note that for the record. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle.
I think, Madam Chair, that taxes has requested
Senator Tomasoni?
I think taxes has requested this so that when it goes out of here, it goes to taxes.
Okay. I'm not sure of what the jurisdiction we have here is, but that definitely sounds like part of taxes. Is there any further testimony or questions to this bill? Seeing none. Anybody want to move the bill?
I'll move the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, or Senator Scalzi moves Senator Tomasoni's bill, 656, to be passed and as amended and sent to...
No, there was no amendment.
Never mind the amendment part, to be passed and sent to
taxes?
Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Oh. Thank you.
Motion carries.
See, the Iron Range was way easier than the Metropolitan.
That's true. All right. Senator Bonoff? Senator Bonoff has Senate File 1688.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, there is an amendment, the A1 amendment.
Okay.
And this is first committee, so it is an author's amendment.
Okay. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment?
Mm-mm.
Oh, here it comes. Did you want to explain your amendment, Senator?
Madam Chair, it is just a technical amendment, so if you could just move it to have the bill in the shape that I'd want, and then I will address it after I talk about the bill specifically.
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Johnson moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor? Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Amendment is adopted. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am sure many of you, like me, have been approached by constituents who have been gone through some kind of a complaint or a situation as an employee of a state agency. And when that happens, and as I mentioned state agency, I'm also including MNSCU. When that happens, it's always quite troubling. And I have, over the years, I have gotten involved in several of these situations where you have to wonder, have these investigations been done impartially and to the best of our ability with best practices? And so there was the situation with regard to the Todd Hoffner case at MNSCU, the Mankato State, last year. And at that time, we asked the legislative auditor to take a look at that case. And there is an OLA report in your package, and I would draw your attention to pages 6 and 7 in that report, or I can review that with you. But on page 6 in the investigation, I would point to the last sentence on that page that says, according to the investigator, her interviews with the two students were not conducted under oath, they were not recorded, and the investigator destroyed her contemporaneous interview notes after she prepared the report that was provided to President Davenport. She told us that the process and protocols she followed in the Hoffner case were consistent with her general practice. It goes on just to talk about how surprised State Auditor Nobles was by the protocols used in this investigation. It talks about having followed up with further with officials in the Office of the Attorney General and the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget and found divided opinion on what does and should occur in personnel investigations. We were told that recordings are sometimes made, as are transcriptions. Moreover, some officials said that contemporaneous interview notes should be maintained, while others said there is no legal requirement. So, members, what this bill does is it actually puts forward a requirement for MMB to create a process. Our state employees deserve predictable and fair investigations. We cannot have a patchwork of investigatory policies among state agencies. Another common theme that has been reported, which is extremely troubling, is that our agencies often are the ones responsible for investigating themselves. As you can imagine, this too prevents a strong conflict of interest. You hear the expression, the fox guarding the hen house. Imagine how it feels if you are the employee who is under investigation. So this legislation requires the commissioner of the Department of MMB to establish policies and procedures that agencies must follow in conducting investigations of their own employees. It mandates that the policies and procedures include reports of all relevant information to the legislative auditor. And currently, this is the law. They are to provide that to the legislative auditor, but we wanted to make certain that with this change, we were not omitting that procedure, which is why it's stated within this. It directs the Board of Trustees from Minnesota State Colleges and Universities to do the same. The policies and procedures developed from this legislation will serve to provide consistency to investigations by agencies and the colleges. The amendment before you were recommendations made by Senate Counsel Ms. James. They are technical. In our statutes, agency covers all of those types of entities. There's just a clarifying change because MNSCU is addressed in Section 2 of the bill. We want to be clear that Section 1 doesn't apply to MNSCU. In addition, it makes clear that the bill isn't authorizing the agencies to conduct any investigation that the agency is not currently permitted to conduct under law. And I'm joined here by, of course, our legislative auditor, Jim Nobles, and so I welcome his comments. But I'm also joined by Dan McCarthy. Dan is a constituent of mine, and I went through a painstaking witnessing his painstaking experience as a Department of Health and Human Services employee. And so I have asked Dan. He's no longer an employee, and the parting was quite painful. And I felt helpless, really, to impact that situation. But I did want to give him a chance to make some remarks in hopes that he could have some sort of a sense of closure that after going through what he went through, that we do take that seriously and that we are willing to reflect and make changes.
Okay. Mr. McCarthy, could you introduce yourself for the record and be succinct? It's getting late.
Sure. My name is Dan McCarthy, and I am a citizen of the state of Minnesota. And until recently, I was a 25-year employee of the state of Minnesota. and I thought what would make the most sense is to simply read my resignation. I'm resigning from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, effective January 2nd, 2015. After many years of public service, it is no longer possible to work at the Department of Human Services and uphold the obligations that have been established for state employees in the state's Code of Conduct. It's numbered 010301. The past couple of years have taken a heavy toll on me and my health and my family. Unfortunately, I was forced to make a decision, and I determined it was not possible for me to return to public service after a major health event. And my requests for alternative work assignments were rejected by the department. So therefore, I also chose to retire at the time of my resignation. It's hoped that through the in writing my resignation, I expressed hope that those who have oversight responsibilities will make the needed changes to assure that no public employee ever suffers the degrading, the discriminatory, the harassing, and retaliatory treatment that I did for reporting unethical and what appeared to be illegal activities. No public employee with a disability is ever treated in a degrading, discriminatory, harassing in a harmful manner that is intended to aggravate their medical condition. And that no state agency is ever tasked with investigating or overseeing the investigation of itself. And finally, that you take some action so state agencies do not utilize public resources to shield themselves from the truth and accountability. I say that because I have an ethical responsibility. You've charged public employees to come forward and speak the truth even when it is, you know, when you need to hear it. And those responsibilities are laid out in a code of conduct. I believe I did the best job that I could under some pretty extraordinary circumstances. And I will tell you, as I told Senator Bonoff After my, I guess, 3 or more year ordeal, I would never advise any other public employee to do what I did. There simply is not the independence and in the integrity in the process. I reported an act only to become the subject of a very, I don't know, troubling series of investigations. So I became the investigated entity because I reported things that I felt it was important for those with oversight responsibilities to understand. And right now, I could never recommend that to another coworker or friend. It's too devastating. So that's what I have to share.
And Madam Chair, this hearing is certainly not a review of that case, nor am I asking this committee to do that. I just, because it was the inspiration, along with the Hoffner case, for the bill, I wanted to allow Mr. McCarthy to make that statement.
Mr. McCarthy, I'd like to thank you for testifying. I'm sorry about your experience. Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Nobles, legislative auditor, I want to say two things. One, thank you to Senator Bonoff for bringing this forth. We did find what we found, what we thought was a very alarming aspect of the investigation that was conducted of Coach Hoffner, which she already referenced, which was stated in our report. I also want to say thank you to Dan McCarthy and confirm that he did come forth to us and reported a situation at the Department of Human Services, and that we followed up on that with an audit and found some very troubling problems within the Department of Human Services eligibility determination system and reported that to the legislature. Unfortunately, then events started to occur, as Mr. McCarthy has indicated, and I felt that I had to let the department handle its personnel matter, and I felt that we did not have the authority to intervene into that. So we did what we could, which was to take the information that Mr. McCarthy provided us, investigated that, and the problems that he pointed out were very real, and they needed to be brought forth, and they needed to be addressed, and we did that.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Senator Bonoff, I can only say as a 35-year state employee that this is not unusual, and I'm sorry to say that. But I do believe you've set up the fox guarding the hen house here. This is the state fixing itself. And but is there anyone else who has comments?
Madam Chair, I did ask Mr. Nobles to help me with this language, and so I believe it was recommended this way so that we could then understand what process they are proposing, and would hope that this committee would ask to revisit this when that proposal is done.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add one point,
Nobles,
because I think it's important in reference to your comment. These matters do have to be reported to the Office of the Legislative Auditor under law. And so I understand your concern that oftentimes they may be left internally to be examined. But if the law is followed, the things like Mr. McCarthy brought forth will be reported to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We don't know what we don't know.
Right.
So until Mr. McCarthy came forth, we didn't know, even with auditing over at the department, the extent of the problem. So I do hope that we can protect state employees who come forth with concerns, and they will be investigated in a very independent way. We issued a report yesterday, Madam Chair, which I know you're very aware of, which addressed a situation that had not been properly addressed within the University of Minnesota. And because of the efforts of, again, Senator Bonoff coming to the Legislative Auditor's Office, we were able to use our authority to fully investigate that matter and issue a report. That is the way the system is supposed to work. And it does work sometimes, Madam Chair. I wish it would work more effectively all the time, though.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles and Senator Bonoff, for bringing this forward. I will. I'm grateful to hear that the results will be reported to you and that we can follow up on this. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none. Senator Dahl?
I move the bill, Senate File 1688 as amended.
And where does it go?
Madam Chair, if it could go to Finance, we didn't get a fiscal note, but we do want to make sure that there will not be a fiscal impact of the department.
Senator Bonneff, I'm aware it goes to Finance.
Thank you.
So Senator Dahl moves Senate File 1688 as amended and to be passed and sent to Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
We're on Franzen. Senator Franzen. Senator Franzen, I assume we're starting with 1438.
Yes.
Okay. Please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And this should be a quick and simple bill. It's a one paragraph in language. It allows the Office of Administrative Hearings to contract with retired workers, comp judges, and then doing this will allow the agency to retain decades-long expertise of these judges for specialized court dockets and or to help train new judges. For example, I was made aware that one of the judges that had carried a full caseload of presiding asbestos calendar for years is retiring on May 1st, and she's willing to come back for a few hours per month to hear just those cases, and doing so ensures that injured workers and employers are well served by the experts in this complicated area of law. So both sides of the workers' comp bar support the bill, the Minnesota Association for Justice and the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, and the Workers' Comp Advisory Council supports this bill. It's cost neutral, and I have with me one testifier, Ms. Tammy Post, who will give a little brief commentary here and then hopefully answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Tammy Poost. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and Senator Franzen actually has done a great job explaining the bill, so I'll simply stand for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the judge or senator? Seeing none, Senator Johnson moves Senate File 1438 to be passed and sent to the floor. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Bill is passed.
Thank you.
Now we move to Senate File 934. Senator Franzen.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 934, I'm not going to go to all the substantive parts of the bill because it's already gone through Health and Human Services, Housing, and through Commerce, where we tackled all that. The jurisdiction of this committee is to look at the advisory group that's being proposed in the bill, and that's on section, and then we have an amendment for that section, so maybe we should start with that so I can speak to that.
Do we have the amendment?
Yes, it's in the packets.
Okay.
A5.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, it looks like the amendment is reworking the advisory council language for our purposes, so I'll move the A5 amendment. So it's before us.
Senator Pappas moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, the jurisdiction of the committee is to look at section 25, subdivision 6, which is the advisory group, and the amendment was recommended by council to be specific on the composition of the group as well as make it clear that it will not have any compensation to members of the group attached to the bill, making this hopefully cost neutral as well unless there is any fiscal note from the department, which I'm not sure if that's been made aware from that angle. But other than that, it's clarifying that it's not going to be a group that's going to be compensated in any way. But there is some support from the Department of Health to have a part of the report that's charged with the group to put together. So I stand for questions, but it's a generic, advisory group that you tend to see a lot of those in your committee.
Right. Are there any questions from the committee? Yes. Senator Housley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Franzen. I'm just wondering about the composition of the representatives that you have. Eight of them that represent the doctors and patients, but only three of them that represent the plans. Can you just explain how you came up with that balance?
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Housley. We came together with the Minnesota Medical Association, who's a big advocate for this bill, and certainly open for suggestions, but we try to put all the different stakeholders. So I guess the math came up to be what you have in front of you, but the composition of stakeholders, I think we have all of them on board in the advisory council.
Thank you.
Would you like to invite your testifiers?
I don't have any testifiers. I have people in case members have questions, but I don't have any testifiers.
If there are people who would like to testify, would you come up to the table, please?
But, Madam Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm hoping they're just going to address the advisory council.
Correct. Senator Pappas is correct. We are only discussing the advisory council and the makeup of it in this committee.
As reflected in the amendment.
As reflected in the amendment.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm a contract lobbyist, and I've been recently retained by the Association of County-Based Health Plans to express concerns that we have with this bill. We have provided the concerns on other portions of the bill to Senator Franson in writing as this bill has been moving along. But I want to address the new amendment that we've just seen this morning related to the advisory council. And Madam Chair and members, I really want to talk about things in a little more general fashion. My favorite person commentating on health care these days is Dr. Atul Gawande, who's a surgeon, public health physician, member of the faculty at Harvard, and the surgeon at Brigham and Women's Children's Hospital. He talks about how we have about 68,000 ways that the human body can fail, about 4,000 procedures that physicians in medicine have identified to deal with them, 6,000 drugs that we have created, and many of these are very complex. All of them are interactive. The average American getting 10 surgeries a year, this system has no reliable mechanism for disseminating the new information that we're getting. And this is a task force that is being created to provide advice on these kinds of issues. And I would warn the committee and ask them to very carefully consider as you push this legislation forward whether or not a group of people that are not particularly adept and trained at looking at these very complex systems are going to have the ability to manage the data that's coming before them. Health plans are working in a very complex system with physicians, with advisory committees that we've created to try and look at all of these ideas. We think we've mastered ways of doing that. And we don't believe that this kind of system, based on just volunteer coming to help the commissioner on a basis in which they'll report back on an annual basis, has the time, energy, or knowledge to do this job well as it needs to be done. Madam Chair, it's a big concern. If you didn't see Bloomberg's announcement last Monday, health care expenses in this country are back in swing and are moving up dramatically. They're double the price of inflation in 2014, and it's something that you need to be very, very careful in considering as you move forward. Madam Chair, we look forward to talking with Senator Franson about other portions of the bill as it moves through. I know there are other witnesses that want to speak in particular. One of our individual plans has Itasca Care, and Representative Solberg is here to talk about that as well. I'll yield the remainder of my time to them unless there are questions.
Mr. Solberg, introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you. And it's always a pleasure to be in front of a Senate committee. My name is Lauren Solberg, and I'm representing Itasca County. Itasca County has a county purchasing program for Medicaid called IM Care. It was established in the 1970s and in the late 1970s as one of, I believe, four counties to experiment with this new type of delivery system for Medicaid recipients. It has survived and continues today to be a cost-effective way of delivering comprehensive health care that includes doctors, hospitals, chiropractors, dentists, pharmacists, optometrists, and other health care specialties. The administrator of the IM Care is not able to be here today, so I'm giving some of his thoughts on this particular bill. And I'll keep them just to the section that you want.
Thank you.
Itasca IM Care strongly believes that the task force will do nothing to improve or enhance to make the care of the patients or make the system more cost effective. A few years ago, there was an effort to eliminate IM care. I was in the legislature at the time and fought hard to preserve this very good and cost-effective program. One of the reasons at the time was that the administrative costs of IM care was too low. And I'm not kidding. That was one of the reasons for trying to eliminate IM care. IM care is very popular with all health care providers and with the patients. It's working very well, and I'm glad that the administrative costs are very low. I do not think that the task force is going to provide any type of more information that we already have. I and IM Care is committed to work with the author to try to address the concerns that exist in the bill, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify for you today.
Thank you, Mr. Solbert. Well, the gentleman, introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Sure. Thank you. It's David Root with Prime Therapeutics. We are a pharmacy benefit manager headquartered here in Minneapolis area, and we represent a primary client in Minneapolis is Minnesota Blue Cross Blue Shield. Speaking to the very specific section of the bill and the amendment offered forward, it's really sort of puts us in a very interesting position. We support any opportunity for the legislature to learn, and we believe that this section of the bill is just such an opportunity, not only for the legislature to learn, but for other departments and commissions to become educated on the process of drug benefits and how they're utilized. We support that effort. What I find perplexing and what makes this difficult is that this measure is in the middle of a bill that attempts to eliminate many of the utilization management programs that this study section wants to study. I would say that it would be my recommendation that if they want to study this and understand the impacts of these utilization managements, let's study those before we pass the bill. So we are in support of learning. We are not in support of learning after the fact.
Thank you. Is there a Diedrichs, Dave Diedrichs? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dave Diedrichs, and I'm here on behalf of Express Scripts, the nation's largest and leading pharmacy benefits manager. Our company's mission is to make the use of prescription drugs safer and more affordable. Our clients include health plans, Fortune 500 companies, labor interests, as well as government entities. We are opposed to Senate File 934, and in this particular section, I just want to focus a little bit on the advisory group and the lack of expertise that's outlined in the group that will be making recommendations and providing information to the health committee chairs. Express Scripts has a P&T committee that stands for Pharmacy and Therapeutics. It is the nation's leading group of doctors with disease state expertise that meets on a quarterly basis to make recommendations after reviewing all the appropriate drug literature as well as medical opinions so that they can appropriately analyze drug trends and make recommendations to our clients on how to best design their benefits to make them affordable and safe. Our P&T committee, along with our in-house doctors, physicians, nurses, and pharmacoeconomists, put together the nation's leading drug trend report that was actually just released a little over 3 weeks ago. It's released on an annual basis. It's completely public. It received a lot of notoriety from the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNBC, MSNBC, and numerous other major media outlets. It breaks down every single drug class and disease state and compares utilization review. It is comprehensive because we represent 85 million people in this country. So it's not singularly based on one state and its data that it says that we must cooperate in providing to the state without any protections for confidentiality. Just to give you an idea about how comprehensive our analysis is, our drug trend report annually is over 200 pages. It does break down every disease state and medication as well as drugs that are in current pipelines. But it is considered to be so forward-thinking and nation-leading that entities like the CDC come to us when they need information. Just a few years ago when the Daiichi Fukushima reactor had a leak in Japan, there was a scare and a scarcity of iodine pills in the United States. So the CDC actually came to us to get information because our information is more comprehensive than anything that they could put together. And after doing a comprehensive nationwide data analysis and heat map, we found that all of the iodine pills had been shipped to the West Coast and been taken in Washington, Oregon, and California because they were concerned about radiation coming over the ocean. This is the kind of information that we already provide to our clients, so we don't see it necessary for a group of individuals that are appointed to come together and make such recommendations to the legislature. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, did you
wish? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Rood, and maybe even Mr. Griffin. It sounds like your testimony, and it was kind of a little bit that Senator Housley was going down, that the composition, because that's kind of what we're discussing today, that the composition of the individuals that Senator Franzen has put together in her bill does not have the expertise that you think that it would need. So I guess my question would be, if this legislation moves forward and we do have a mix of folks on the Prescription Drug Advisory Council, what would be the right composition in your expert opinion? Mr. Root?
The testifier.
Or Mr. I'm sorry, to the testifier.
Oh, I apologize.
Or whoever really wants to ask a question, but you I think to the testifier, you really did say that your company was an expert and you really didn't think that we had the expertise. So maybe we should start with you and then the other witnesses. I'm sorry.
Mr. Diedrichs?
Mr. Yes, Diedrichs.
I apologize, Senator.
I missed.
I don't know if a composition is necessary. I think the private market has already taken care of this. And I think that the private market has the necessary nationwide expertise as opposed to individuals appointed that are going to be looking at only individual states' analyses.
Right. So you wouldn't find this to be necessary?
No.
Okay. I thought you might say that. Mr. Griffin?
Mr. Griffin, please proceed.
Senator Hayden, Phil Griffin again from the County-Based Purchasing Plans. I'd agree with the same thing. The expertise that you need to examine in the last 5 years, we've had between 20 and 27 drugs approved by the FDA. This kind of task force simply does not have the expertise to review those sorts of things.
Right. So, Madam Chair and Senator Franzen, I think that that's just what I really wanted to say was that the testifiers, and I appreciate it, and they're including former Representative Solberg, they just don't like the bill and they don't think that it is necessary. And I just want to make sure the committee understands that position versus what I thought I was hearing was maybe there's a different composition that we could put together that could work. It's just that they are opposed to it, and that's their right, and we understand that. I just wanted to ensure that the committee understood that that was their position.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Dahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Senator Hayden, you're on the right track. Of course, the private companies, I think their goal would be to make money. I understand that. In terms of the expertise, as I've heard this bill in commerce, I really do want to know what patients are thinking about accessibility to prescription drugs. I really want to know what the physicians, non-physicians, the pharmacists, everybody that's affected by current law, I would think that we would want more information to know how to make the law better. So it's like we don't need this because we think we're doing a good job right now. The reason this bill came here because we're not doing a good job right now. And if we can get some advisors with people like me on it who really don't get into that field that would share their concerns so it isn't, this groupthink that a bunch of like-minded folks that are all experts on the subject get together and say everything's peachy, I think that's part of the problem. So, Senator Franzen, thank you for bringing a bill that's thoughtful, that really wants to try to get public reaction and input on a bill that I think is really needed. So, ready to move the bill whenever we're ready.
Mr. Solberg, did you want to add something?
David Root, sorry.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I understand. Just very quickly to the point of the makeup of the council. So an important point that may or may not be lost on members of the committee, legal guidelines require the P&T committees that are established by organizations such as mine, Express Scripts, and organizations such as large employers. There are many, often large employers, that will develop their own P&T committee. It's required that those people have, I guess, to put it in simplest terms, no skin in the game, so that these are clinicians that are not impacted by pharma. They are not impacted by PBMs. They are not impacted by health plans. These are clinicians, nurses, doctors, pharmacists, and researchers that are specifically held secret so that they are not able to be swayed by those various influences. And often there are limited patient aspects to those committees simply because the point of the committee is to get to the most effective ethical use of the product and what products need to be on the formularies. And as a patient, they are often, we are all often subject to the direct advertising of consumers and our various personal views.
Mr. Hayden.
I don't want to belabor the point, but we kind of got to this in the Health Committee a little bit and we went through it. But that your statement kind of gets to the point of why Senator Franzen wants to push the bill, because you feel like patients and doctors and others don't have a skin in the game in terms of the delivery of pharmaceuticals. And I would argue that they do. They have as much skin in the game as everybody else, maybe different than your perspective. But that is kind of the issue, and that's kind of what we dealt with in the Health Committee too, is that this group of folks that are the experts that deliver the prescription drugs feel like this is really their territory and that they simply know best. And we're just saying that we're not sure that's it, and that's why Senator Franzen is bringing the bill. And I think that's what Senator Dahl was trying to say, that we have a little bit of a different view, and we think that the patients and the doctors and others in the healthcare team also have stake in the game.
Senator Franzen, would you like to wrap it up?
Yes, I would. Just briefly, to Mr. Griffin's point, I haven't received your comments in writing, so I'd love to see them. So let's make sure we connect on that.
Senator Franzen, I'm sorry, but Senator Johnson wanted to speak.
And sure.
I thought maybe you'd want her to speak before you wrapped up.
It'll be a very simple question for Senator Franzen, and that is that I noticed that you're not going to appoint until October of 2015, and I'm wondering if there's a reason. That's a little unusual. Most of the time it's sooner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator
Franzen.
Senator Johnson. To wrap it up, I will get to your point my remarks, because, Mr. Root talked about it's great that we want to learn and study. This isn't about learning and study. If you read the language of the bill on Section 1.30, this group is charged for a narrow scope to describe the trends in prescription drug coverage, formulary design, medication exception request, and benefit design. So the bill this area changes daily, and the people and the experts that have already testified can attest to that. This area in prescription drugs and changes in formularies, this changes daily, and there's new advances in medicine on a daily basis. So it's not studying that. This is studying the changes that are occurring moving forward. My bill overall deals with, what the issue is that I've heard from patients, which is they're not getting the medications they need when they need it. So this committee and this advisory committee, I feel strongly, will continue to look at those trends, has the appropriate expertise. I think, either company that testified, which are both located in my district, are perfect people to be appointed to one of these advisory council positions because of the expertise they bring. So we're trying to bring people to the table to address a very real issue that we have currently in the system. If you hear from Jim Nobles from the Legislative Auditor's Office, he has a phrase that he used yesterday in committee, trust but verify. I trust that the private sector is doing a great job, but I want to verify that. And this is the point of this committee, to have this advisory council, to bring all the stakeholders that are so hard to bring to the table to talk about this. And in closing, just to give you some financial perspective of why we want to talk about this issue, the MDH just had a report in June 2014 with 2012 numbers of how much we're spending as a state in health care. I don't know if you knew this, but it's $39.8 billion, which is 13.5% of the state's economy, and it's projected to rise to $76.5 billion by 2022. If we just have actual costs in health care, it would be $27 billion, with a B. Of that, 8.6% is prescription drugs, which is $3.4 billion. The state has a stake in this issue, and that is why we have to evaluate trust, but we need to verify. So I encourage for the committee to support this information, because we can't make legislation and progress in healthcare costs that are going through the roof if we don't know and have that granular data available and bring the stakeholders together, which in my experience with this bill has been very difficult.
Senator Franzen, I didn't hear why we're not starting till October.
Oh, sorry. So we're not starting to October.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The report will be in 2017, January 15th, so we do need time for the committee to get together and make the time to put the information together. So that's why the delay of the bill, it's also effective in August. So I'm open to changing that, and we're certainly open to changing that, but we're trying to give some time for the law to be effective and then bring the group together to see how it's doing.
Thank you, Senator Franzen. Senator Dahl moves that Senate file. Where am I at?
934,
as amended, be passed and sent to Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Bill carries.
Thank
passes.
You, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Oh, they're the ones that couldn't come till later. Oh, that's fine. I got a frog in my throat, as usual. No problem.
Okay, here I am. I'm back, taking over the committee. Last bill on our agenda is Senate Bill 1703, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have 1703, the American Indian and Indigenous Peoples Day Establishment. This bill establishes the second Monday in October as the American Indian and Indigenous Peoples Day to acknowledge and promote Minnesota's American Indian and Indigenous community. The bill also recognizes the annexation of Dakota and Ojibwe lands to create the state of Minnesota and the importance of closing pervasive disparities. Private and public entities are encouraged to also recognize the American Indian and Indigenous Peoples Day. I would like my testifiers to elaborate.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Kennedy.
Thank you. Madam Chair, distinguished members of the State and Local Government Committee, it's a pleasure to be here with you today. My name is Ellen Kennedy. I am the Executive Director of World Without Genocide, a human rights organization at William Mitchell College of Law, where I also am an adjunct professor. Holidays represent important milestones and events. As individuals and as families, we delight in birthdays, anniversaries, graduations, and weddings, times that celebrate who we are. As cultural, national, ethnic, and religious groups, we also celebrate who we are. The 4th of July, Christmas, Hanukkah, Ramadan, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, President's Day, and many other publicly recognized days. We also have certain days to recognize important issues. January 1st is Global Family Day. March 8th is International Women's Day, and more. But our calendars have an important absence. We don't have a day to celebrate American Indian culture or to commemorate the history of Indigenous peoples. This absence is profound in its silence. It lets us remain blind to the past and to ignore the challenges of today and tomorrow. A number of cities throughout the United States, beginning with Berkeley, California in 1992, and most recently Red Wing and Minneapolis in 2014, have named the second Monday in October as a holiday to commemorate Native American and Indigenous people. The state of South Dakota has taken this step as well. Some cities and states have replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. This bill does not advocate for that kind of change, but adds this day in October as American Indian and Indigenous Peoples Day, keeping it consistent with most state and local designations. This state bill will encourage us all to celebrate past and present contributions of these people to our local, state, and national culture. It will encourage us, as Senator Eaton said, to address challenges in the present and in the future. About 16,200 American Indian students attend public schools in Minnesota. These young people are the cultural identity of their future. This designation and its celebration by schools and other organizations provides dignity, honor, and recognition to their heritage. Many of you undoubtedly have American Indians in your districts, people whose stories we may not fully know. This bill honors them. We have just commemorated the 50th anniversary of the March on Selma, when whites, blacks, Asians, Jews, and others all joined together in the name of freedom and education. We can all stand together today to honor the Native legacy in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kennedy. Are there any questions for her? Then Ms. Anne Marie Hill.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Marie Hill, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. I'm also a proud member of the Red Lake Nation and a citizen of the state of Minnesota. The bill before you represents an acknowledgement of the many contributions of Indigenous people to our region and state. Most people in our state are unaware of the deep, rich history of American Indians and how this history impacts us daily. For example, every time you pull out your driver's license and hand someone your ID, you are acknowledging a contribution. The name Minnesota, or Minnesota, comes from the Dakota. It literally means sky-tinted water. And when you are on Interstate 94, heading from Minneapolis to St. Paul, the state capital, and you cross over the second longest river in the United States, the Mississippi, and you refer to it by name, you are literally speaking Ojibwe. Again, many of our citizens remain unaware of these simple facts. This bill would give Minnesotans an opportunity to take a day to reflect and possibly become better informed about our Indigenous people and the many contributions to our state. By adding to the name of a state-recognized holiday in this historic and significant bill, you are signifying that Minnesota is willing to make much-needed and meaningful changes to our understanding how we arrived at this place. Thank you, Senators Eaton and Senator Pappas and Dr. Ellen Kennedy, for bringing this bill forward today. The Minnesota Indian Affairs Council supports this bill.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. We have two other people who asked to testify, and if you want to let them come to the table, that's Jay Badhart Bull and Bill Means. Welcome to the committee. It's a privilege to have you here today, both of you.
Thank you. It's an honor. I'll defer to my elder, Bill Means, to speak first.
Mr. Means.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and Madam Chair. My reason for being here as a citizen of the state of Minnesota and a proud member of the Lakota and Dakota peoples is to support this bill based on the fact of our continued reconciliation and also recognition of Indian peoples as an important contribution to the state. I'm sure we have a lot more in common with the people of Minnesota and Indian people than we have with Christopher Columbus. And so on that fact, I would say in that spirit of working together, of reconciliation, of recognizing the history of the state of Minnesota and the contributions of all of us, that we support this bill, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Badhart Bull.
Uh, Thank you very much for allowing us to speak today in front of you. My name is J. Thomas Badhart Bull. I run an organization in Minneapolis called the Native American Community Development Institute. And last year, we organized the change from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day in the city of Minneapolis, which was a landmark victory for our community and for this region. We would like to see this momentum shift into the state level and have all of Minnesota's residents celebrate our contributions to this land, the history. American Indians have the highest per capita of service in our armed forces. We've given everything for this place to call home. And in a state that suffers from the highest rate of disparities, the American Indian people are at the bottom of that barrel. And small steps like this can help right those wrongs and give our community and our state a sense of pride and purpose as we move forward as American Indian people and contributing members of this great state. Thank you very much, and I'm very supportive of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thanks to Senator Eaton for bringing this and for all the great testimony that we've heard today. I grew up near Red Lake, so I'm quite aware of what you spoke of. Thanks for coming. And the town that I represent, that I live in, is Little Canada, and we always talk about how we settled in 1844, but we settled with the help of the Dakota people at that time in that place. So we all have long roots that would help with this. And I'm just kind of curious, maybe someone here knows, I haven't been everywhere in the Capitol and on the Mall, but do we have a representation in a statue form of the Native American culture in Minnesota? I know we have various, you know, generals and governors and all that, but is there any other representation? And maybe I've missed it.
Madam Chair?
Senator Eaton.
The only thing I'm aware of is some pretty inappropriate pictures.
Senator Scalzi.
And thank you, Ms. Chair. And that would be, I think, where we should carry this further, because we certainly need to have representation of the bedrock of our state. So thank you.
Senator Hayden.
Oh, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this is a great bill. Thank you, Senator Eaton. Somehow I missed it on the bill introduction, so I would have had my name on the bill. I represent the Little Earth community, which is the largest urban Indian communities in the country. And
there's
so,
still room, Senator Hayden, on the bill.
You know, well, no, I have it here. I'm going to make sure I get on it. But thank you so much, Senator Pappas and Senator Eaton. I think that this is an outstanding bill to commemorate the contributions of our indigenous American Indian community. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Is there any other? Senator Eaton.
Madam Chair, I was just going to move the bill.
I just want to check. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Is there any other discussion on the behalf of the committee? Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment that I really am happy you brought this forward. And as Ms. Kennedy mentioned about students in Minnesota, I had some students from my district, American Indian students, and we were talking about ways that they feel more valued and included, and I think doing things like this is important, and I'm happy you brought it forward.
Thank you.
Okay, then, Senator Eaton.
I would like to move Senate File 1703 to be passed and
sent to the floor.
Sent to the floor.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. This is a little unprecedented. Before I adjourn the committee, I'm just wondering if the witnesses and the authors could gather at the end of the table for a photo. Committee's adjourned. So stay right there. Thank you.